BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. As a rule of thumb, one species cannot mate with another species, and that very fact is a way of telling species apart. But there are hybrids, which were once thought the exception to this rule, the offspring of different species. Yet the more we look, the more common these hybrids appear to be, and the more vital to evolution from the beginning of life to now and from now onwards. And they challenge our idea of what a species is and what separates one species from another. With me to discuss hybrids are Sandra Knapp, tropical botanist at the Natural History Museum, Nicola Nadeau, lecturer in evolutionary biology at the University of Sheffield, and Steve Jones, senior research fellow in genetics at University College London. Steve Jones, can you tell us what a hybrid is?
Well, you've given us already the simple definition, and which is an individual whose parents come from two different species across. Classic example, of course, which people tend to know about, are things like mules, which are the offspring of horses and donkeys, and in fact sterile. But they were always thought to be little quirks, as you said. The descriptions of species, the real question is, what is a species? The original feeling of what a species was a kind of stamp collector's model, where there's a great Swedish naturalist, Linnaeus, simply went out there, looked at all the kinds of creatures he could find, and gave them names, Latin names, Homo sapiens, for example, the species to which many of us claim to belong. And that was fine, but of course, suddenly, soon, and really quite soon, things began to change, because species are, by definition, rather fluid things. They exist in space, but also in time, and they change with time, and that was Darwin's idea. And of course, Darwin was very worried about how species changed, and his book The Origin of Species is a wonderful book, but it's not really about species, because he was so confused about what species are, and we're still pretty confused, I have to say.
But when did that clarify to the notion that there are lots of hybrids, and species is a wobbly word, and we get to the situation in which we are now? Because Linnaeus said there's that and that, all that was done in all over the place, and then it's all gone.
It hasn't all gone. I have a certain sympathy with that Linnaeus view, because in many cases it appears that different species look different and they never interbreed. But if you take ourselves, for example, there were many people, not just Linnaeus, but people much more recent than that, who saw Africans and Europeans, say, as either being different species or different races. And by races, they meant groups of creatures that were biologically different and perhaps should be stopped from interbreeding, whatever the political implications of that. That was the biological view. What really changed it was the beginnings of molecular genetics, the ability to look beneath the skin, to look at chromosomes, for example, or to look at protein variation, and now, of course, to look at DNA. And now the whole thing, it's the beautiful simplicity of Mendelism of genetics, which is based on counting peas, has turned into pea soup. And that's kind of happened to the idea of species too.
But can you just give us the impact that this had? And you've gone to pea soup a bit too quickly for most people. Why did it change things so radically?
Well, it was a sort of attack upon the doctrine, really. And if you've spent your life in the Natural History Museum, as some people I'm told have, classifying species and naming them and making up far-fetched names for extraordinarily rare creatures, it's a bit of a blow to find that what you thought was a clear-cut subject, like arithmetic, isn't like that. It's like calculus, it's continuous variation. It was a big leap from arithmetic to calculus, and it's a big leap from the Linnaean view of species, species are units which you can add together, to the modern species, where they tend to blend in a rather embarrassing way.
Can you give us a few examples of hybrids in the natural world? Because now we can see them not only around us now, but through tracking back we can see them to 200,000 years, from 200,000 years, and on it goes.
Yes, you can see them in many places. I mean, they're much more common in plants than in animals, and that's perhaps something we could explore. But there, for example, in Britain, there's a very familiar hybrid plant which has become rather a pest, which is called the Oxford ragwort. And this is a hybrid between an Italian volcanic rare species on broken rocks in Italy and a native species of native relatives. variety which was grown in the Oxford Botanic Gardens. And they hybridized and formed the plant which everybody has seen millions of without realizing. Because whenever you go on the train, you look out of the window, there are tons and tons, millions of these bright yellow flowered plants. They're all hybrids, and they're all new hybrids. They're not more than 200 years old.
And there are many, many more.
There are many examples.
Hybrids have been they've invaded the world of species.
Yes, I would say so. And in animals too, there are hybrid mice, there are hybrid fruit flies. It's all a bit of a nightmare.
Why is it a nightmare?
Life. You know, many of us can say this at our age. Life used to be so simple.
I see. Okay, we'll let that pass. All right, Nicola, maybe for you, Nicola Nardo. Can we say with any certainty? I'm going to go back to the idea of a species because Steve was including a lot of other stuff there. What a species is. First of all, what was thought to be and what it is now.
Most people will probably be most familiar with the biological species concept. So the idea that that things are species if they can't interbreed and produce fertile offspring. But I think lots of people now realise that this is quite a restrictive definition. And actually, there are lots of things that we consider as distinct species that can hybridise. So one example would be beluga whales and narwhals. People find hybrids of them, but you would also clearly be able to recognise one, in general, recognise them in the world as one species or another. So most people now, I think, recognise that there can be some hybridisation, but that in order for things to be defined as different species, there has to be a set of characteristics that are always found in each of the species and are distinct. And so it's that sort of set of multiple traits always occurring together that really is one way of defining a species. But there are other ways, and there is still this kind of ongoing debate about how species should be defined.
Can you give us two or three examples to illustrate what you've just said?
There's another whale example. So I gave the example of the belugas and the narwhals.
Let's stick with the whales.
Blue whales and fin whales are another example, so they can also hybridise. There are lots of bird examples. So the Lady Amherst pheasant and the golden pheasant can hybridise. So many different things that we consider to be distinct species will hybridise given the right circumstances.
Given the invasion of hybridisation, how does this Linnaean stamp collector idea, which Steve pointed to at the beginning of the programme, how does that still operate? Is it operable? Is it useful anymore that there are these distinct species?
I think it is useful in some ways. So, for example, conservation is one area where we need to be able to say how many species there are, what are species, because we want to be able to conserve biodiversity. In that context, being able to define a species is useful. Also, just for lots of our daily lives as biologists, we refer to things as species, and I think lots of biologists appreciate that there is some sort of fluidity in that, but just in terms of being able to describe the natural world around us, we still need to name things to some extent.
Can a hybridisation event, as it were, between two, can that turn into a species? Eventually?
Yes. So there are known examples of hybrid speciation where two species hybridise and their hybrid offspring then become their own separate species.
And how do you note that? When is it after a number of years, or is it because they themselves had offspring? What goes on?
So it all, our definition of species still sort of comes down to the biological species concept and this idea that species are populations that have this restricted gene flow between them. So they're populations that don't exchange, in general, don't exchange genetic material between them. So it would become a hybrid species when it ceases to reproduce with its two parental species. So there's some sort of barrier that prevents it from interbreeding with its parental species.
Thank you. Sandy Knapp, I suppose we could say, what is species for? What did they deliver for knowledge that's important?
Well, I think one of the important things that Nicola touched on is that they give us a way to talk about nature. So they give us a sort of a unit that we can communicate about. And it's very difficult to communicate unless you have quite simple language in which to communicate. And species names, the way Linnaeus set them out to have a genus name, like our genus name is Homo and our species name is Sapiens, having those two words is very much like the kind of noun adjective structure of the English language. So it comes very naturally to us to talk about things in that way. So you know that two species of the genus Solanum, on which I work, that they kind of are closer together because they have that same genus name in common, but they're different species with different names. So I think it's a mechanism for communication. I mean, that really, and in a way that goes back to what the definition of a species is. To some extent, Darwin in The Origin of Species said that a species is what a good taxonomist says it is, which is fine. And I always like to think of species as being hypotheses. So they're our best estimate of the distribution of variation in nature. So if you think of nature as a kind of lumpy carpet, it's the lumps that we can talk about are what we call species.
Darwin hadn't the advantage of knowing about genetics, so did he get as near as he could have done in his Origin of Species because of that lack?
Well, I think he didn't know about genetics, but he did know about things crossing. So most of Darwin's books are about plants. So most of Darwin's books are about crossing plants. And he did a book about the different forms of flowers on the same species, and he was very clear that outcrossing, so crossing not with yourself, because plants have a flowering plant is a hermaphrodite, so it has both male and female parts. And so he very clearly laid out that it was better for things to outcross, so not to cross with themselves, but to cross to a different individual. And that's a kind of hybridization as well. So hybridization is almost a continuum between crossing with another individual and not with yourself. I mean, we can't cross with ourselves because we're either male or we're female. We're what plant people would call dioecious. All the way up to things like orchids, with which you can cross genera. You can cross way high up from species, and there are orchid generic hybrids, which are created by orchid breeders, which have 9 genera associated in them.
What would that mean? Can you give us a specific?
What that would mean is
an orchid crossed with. Can you give us 6?
Yeah.
Or 7
let's say the orchids that people used to give people for prom flowers, you know, the great big blousy orchids, crossed with a smaller white orchid. You would cross those two. You put the pollen from one of those onto the female parts of another, and then you'd get the seeds and germinate them, and then do the same thing again with a different flower and a different one, and you'd get plants.
But always in the orchid, in the area of orchids.
Orchids are particularly they're particularly promiscuous in this respect.
Really?
Yeah, they're quite incredible.
Orchids are being promiscuous.
Yeah, well, they are. They're terrible. They're at it all the time. Orchids. They're awful.
Yeah. Well, I'll just take a deep breath there. and did Darwin give us indication? Maybe we can switch to Steve here. But if you could start of the impact that hybridization was having on evolution.
I think he did in his book about the evolution of plants and animals under domestication, because there was a lot in there about not only plants but also animals, about different breeds crossing and different species crossing. But the idea of hybridization, Linnaeus recognized that there were hybrids. He wasn't quite, I'm going to disagree with Steve here, but he wasn't quite as clear-cut as that. He recognized that with many plants that there were intermediates and that they could cross. And the very first plant hybrid that people know about was made in the 17th century, long before Linnaeus, by Thomas Fairchild, whose church is in the middle of the Barbican.
Steve?
Yes, that's
true.
Can
you take both those things up, please?
Yes, I mean, there's always elements of circularity in trying to define what a species is. There's a neat example with dogs and wolves. Now, dogs, the domestic dog is Canis familiaris. The wolf is Canis lupus. And you wouldn't really want to have a wolf on your carpet, okay? But in fact, if you look at the DNA of dogs and wolves, wolves have now got lots of dog DNA in them, and dogs are in fact wolves, a special kind of wolf which we've selected. So now that the domestic dog, at least to some species namers of species, has the same name, Canis lupus, as the wolf. So your little terrier has the same status as does a gigantic wild creature of the forest.
Well, I have a little terrier, and she'll be very surprised.
She'll probably be quite pleased, actually. Yeah. but I think there are examples, and domesticated plants and animals actually are a very good example of things that actually started out being the same. So because and then we changed them through our own actions, like the domesticated tomato or the potato or wheat or aubergines. Yeah. And actually, at the end, they probably deserve to be called different species as a domesticated plant or animal and a wild one, because they're on very different evolutionary trajectories.
Can I just come back to Steve for a second here? In the case of animals, what are, let's call it the parameters genetically for sexual reproduction, what's needed?
Well, sex tends to help. And yeah,
you better explore that a little more deeply.
But I mean, we've just heard about the enormous diversity and the promiscuity of the orchids. And that's because there's been a co-evolution, as we say, a sort of arms race between the orchids and all flowers and their pollinators, their insect pollinators. And the reason, one of the reasons for enormous diversity in flowers and pollinators is that the interests of the two are quite different. And this leads to very rapid speciation. People speaking on the subject always say, from the flower's point of view, an orchid's point of view, a bee is a flying penis, okay? It brings in pollen from somewhere else. And what the orchid wants, in inverted commas, is for its pollinator to be hungry and to be faithful and to be active. Whereas, of course, the pollinator wants exactly the opposite. He wants to be lazy, well-fed, and promiscuous. So there's this complicated arms race that goes on, and you get lots of species as a result. But in fact, that means that the barriers between the orchids are really held in the minds of the pollinators. And the same is true in many birds, for example. You can hybridize the ducks, mallards, and pintails easily, but they don't hybridize in the wild because, to use the technical language, they don't fancy each other. So an awful lot of difference is actually very subtle and held within behavior. Some of it is held within genes, some of it is held very firmly within genes. But it's noticeable that when you have big disturbances of a habitat, as happened, for example, 10,000 years ago in the Middle East, when things began to dry up, different grasses began to hybridize, and they made the breadwheats. Okay, and so it's the same with species as the world has warmed, different pollinators have arrived, and species have begun to change as a result.
Nicola, in your work with butterflies, what have you seen of the advantages of the hybridization?
One of the things that we found when we started to look at the genetic sequence of the butterflies that I work on was that things that we would definitely call different species, so they were different across most of their genomes, actually shared the same genes for particular traits, and one of these was colour pattern. So the butterflies that I work on are called Heliconius. They're from South America. They have these bright colour patterns that advertise their toxicity to predators, so they're warning colours. And so by sharing the genes between species, that then allowed different species to have the same warning colour, and therefore the predators in that area, which would recognise that particular colour, would recognise both species as being toxic. So one species may have newly moved into the area of the existing species, hybridised a little bit with that species, gained some of its colour pattern genes, and then become protected from predators because it then shared the same colour pattern as the species that was already in that area that the birds were already avoiding.
Does this make the butterflies stronger or weaker?
It makes them stronger in an evolutionary sense. So they have a fitness advantage because the predators are avoiding them.
Sandy, there's been references to plants. I think you've had a say in that. That allows them to create hybrids more readily than animals. And Darwin did an immense amount of work on plants. Can you tell us why you think that is and how you think that happens?
Well, I think to a certain extent it has to do with the fact that plants often depend upon other organisms, as Steve said, to bring the pollen from one to another. But there's also widespread gene flow even in things that are wind pollinated, like oaks. I mean, oaks are always, the North American oaks were always the classic example of something that you could never tell the species apart. That they were, that there was too much hybridization and it was impossible to distinguish species. And there's been a bunch of work that's been done recently by people from the Morton Arboretum in Chicago that's shown that despite widespread introgression and huge amounts of gene exchange, you can still diagnose these units that you can talk about, that you can tell apart. So I think botanists never really kind of liked the biological species concept. When it first came out in the 1960s and 70s, many botanists wrote papers saying this doesn't work in plants because we've known for a long time that plants cross with each other relatively easily. And I think what people are finding now, especially with genomics, is that actually this is true in animals as well, is there's quite a lot of crossing and gene exchange, which is another way of saying hybridization. There's a lot of gene exchange, which we just didn't see before. But now with these new tools, we're able to see it. And instead of having a tree like Darwin had in his book of a dichotomously branching tree with everything quite discrete, it's actually a cloud on which you can kind of superimpose this tree, which tells us what the species are, but there's lots of genes which are exchanged between things.
Is there any evidence of an increase in hybrids?
There is some evidence that there's an increase in hybrids, as Steve said, in disturbed areas, because as we create disturbance, we create roadside verges and parking lots and spoil heaps. It's an area where things can come together which in nature may have stayed apart or may have had pollinators which never went between the others, or the wind might not have carried the pollen. But there does seem to be an increase in hybridization. It's also been really important, a particular kind of hybridization called polyploidy, where two things cross and then the cells don't redivide. They have double the chromosome numbers. Has been really important in flowering plant evolution. So there's been these episodes of hybridization which have led to huge diversification in flowering plants, which then was followed by diversification of pollinating insects. So it kind of, it's difficult to tell which came first, the pollinating insects and the flowering plant diversity, or the flowering plant diversity and the pollinating insects, because it's something we can't really tell.
And Steve, this has been developed by men and women. They've developed this earlier. They've seen it happening and developed it for more food, more whatever it is. It hasn't just all happened naturally.
The hybridization?
Yeah.
Oh, no, goodness, no. I mean, the whole basis of agriculture, the whole basis of the world economy, and I say that with some thought, turns on agriculture far more than on oil and coal and that kind of stuff, because we don't need to fly, but we do need to eat. And it was discovered, first of all, inadvertently, that if you hybridize particular plants or animals, for that matter, together, the offspring were often better off. But in the 1930s, that took a much more scientific turn, and there are no famous geneticists called Jones, or actually there's one, Ether, whose collaborator was called East, and these were agricultural geneticists in the US, and that was big in the US. It's very noticeable that many of the major universities in the Midwest were founded as agricultural research stations, and what East and Jones were interested in was the productivity of maize, of Indian corn, as we call it here, and they had the rather banal idea of taking two lines of maize, inbred lines, which had been grown by farmer A and farmer B for many generations, so that A and B were quite different, and crossing them together. And I think they were astonished to find that they got 100% increase in yield. Okay, now that was done 60, 70 years ago, almost by accident. But now that's developed into an extremely sophisticated science, where people go, and Sandy knows much more about this than I do, where people go out into the wild and find wild relatives and find useful genes in the wild relative. And then with a lot of very complicated crossing, they make hybrids which are better than what went before. Tomatoes, of course, wild, for example, in the wild, a small, green, bitter fruits which you would never dream of eating. But with selection and hybridization, now they're beautiful, red, huge, and they don't taste of anything.
And so do you see this is a development which has been destructive as well as constructive, hasn't it?
I think if you're a naturalist and you want to keep diversity together, then clearly we're losing many, many species. We have to bear in mind that our presence in the studio turns on the ability to feed the billions of people in the world, and that rests ultimately on hybridization.
Yes. What do we share our DNA, don't we, as humans, with as I said in the introduction, to some extent with Neanderthals. With anyone else?
Yes. Well, I mean, this too is beginning to turn into a bit of a nightmare. There were historically several species of humans. You can go a long way back, and there would have been many species of hominids anyway, which are relatives of humans. But Homo sapiens, the species which is present nowadays, when it escaped from Africa, and people argue about the date, but it began to fill Europe really about 80,000 years ago. There was already a related species, the Neanderthal was there. Neanderthals were rare, and we know that they were rare because now we can take their DNA, ancient DNA, and we can sequence it, read it from end to end, and it turns out they didn't have much variation, which suggests they'd been inbred, not outbred, not crossing, for a long time. And it's clear, as most people now know, that most Europeans and Chinese and so on have some Neanderthal genes which come from hybridization long ago. Their genes, for example, for resistance to disease are some of them, perhaps because the Neanderthals were resistant to diseases which were present in Europe before Homo sapiens arrived. And as soon as the hybrids appeared, then we took advantage of it. It's a related and neater example of another early hominid called the Denisovans, and these are much less abundant. We know only about them initially from one skeleton or one skull. These seem to have given genes to Tibetans, today's Tibetans, which allows them to breathe very low levels of oxygen. So that's another case of taking advantage of an extinct species to evolve.
So I think those examples, and maybe some of the ones from agriculture, I think that hybridization isn't a bad thing, because it provides evolutionary opportunity. So it allows because, as we know, the species that we have today are not the same ones that we had 100,000 years ago, or not the same ones that we had a million years ago. So evolution is a moving target. It's still happening, and so oftentimes in the field, collecting plants or animals, plants is what I know more about. In the field, you find things that you think might be hybrids, and sometimes they don't persist, and then they're just kind of passing fancy. But sometimes they actually can provide something new that is in a habitat. So I think it's an opportunity rather than something that's bad.
Nicola Nutter, is there any way of predicting the characteristics of a hybrid? And are they always the same? Is it always going to be make them stronger or whatever? Can you predict what's going to happen?
As far as I know, I don't think we can predict. I mean, it depends a lot on the intricacies of the genetics. So in general, we can probably say that a hybrid is going to look somewhere in intermediate between the two parental species. But, of course, that depends a lot on dominance. So if some genes...
What do you mean by dominance in this area?
So I guess the most well-known example is eye colour. So in humans, brown eyes are dominant. Brown eye colour is dominant to blue eye colour. And that's because of the dominance of the genes. So an individual that has two copies of the brown eye gene that reproduces with an individual that has two copies of the blue eye gene, all their children will have brown eyes. Because the brown eye gene is dominant. So that's sort of the best known example, but lots of genes throughout the genome have this dominance, and that means that the dominant gene will be the one that's expressed. So that could mean that the hybrid offspring would look more like one of the parental species than the other.
But as Steve was alluding to earlier, people are breeding for strength. So they're predicting that this and that together will be stronger than this or that separate.
I think you try lots and lots of times, and so when you make a cross to do a plant breeding trial, you make a cross and you plant loads and loads of seeds, and the ones that are the strongest you keep, and then you do it again and you keep the strongest ones and you do it again. So it's a selection from lots of seeds. So it each individual isn't necessarily stronger, but as you keep selecting the strongest one, it becomes stronger.
Can we find an sorry, do you want to say something?
Just to say that also it's not always for strength. It could be for particular characteristics. So you might want to interbreed two plants or animals that have particular, where you want the characteristics of one combined with the characteristics of another. And then in all their offspring, you would try and pick the individuals that then have both of those.
Or disease resistance is a really good example of that.
Can we just take a simple example? What about the potato? Let us consider the potato. What does that illustrate?
Marvelousness. Potatoes are great. Potatoes are a hybrid species. So potatoes are a polyploid. I said earlier there are sort of hybrids that happen with the same numbers of of chromosomes in the offspring as in the two parents. So say you have two plants, each of whom has 12 chromosomes, and they cross, and then their offspring also have 12 chromosomes, and that's one kind of hybridization. And in plants, it's particularly common that what you get is two different species that cross, and then the offspring has double the number of chromosomes. And that's the case in the potato. And the cultivated potato itself is what's called tetraploid, so it has two copies of wild species chromosomes. But we know the potato, one species of potato, but there are four other cultivated potatoes which are only in the high Andes. And they are a complex set of hybrids between the cultivated potato and various wild species of potatoes. So they have very complicated genomes which have bits of lots of different species in them, and it's conferred disease resistance and frost resistance and all sorts of characteristics which adapt them very well to growing high in the Andes, but not so well for British supermarkets.
Steve Jones, there's something called hybrid vigor.
Yep.
When do we find, what's that about?
Well, that's what we found when we talked a few moments ago about the crossing these different inbred lines of maize and other plants. But it's been known for a long time. And strangely enough, it even seems to apply to a degree in humans. If you do large surveys now using the censuses we have of people and people's height and health and that kind of stuff, if you look at the marriages that are registered over the centuries, until about 1870 in Britain, the mean difference between marriage, the birthplace of marriage partners, was about 10 kilometres. Okay, by about 1970, it had been about 100 kilometres or so. And I haven't been able to find the figures for 2019 or 2020, but my guess, looking at my students who come from all over the world, it's probably 200 or 300 kilometres. And what you find is, if you measure the height of individuals who come from parents who were married 10 kilometres apart versus those 100 kilometres apart, the ones from further apart are taller and slightly more intelligent on IQ tests than those who come from close inbred populations. I should point out that my parents were born 5 miles apart.
But that also shows that this, I think that's a really good example of showing that hybridization is something that doesn't just happen between species. It happens between individuals and between, you know, different populations within a species, between genera. Hybridization is not unusual. It's very common. It's just we didn't think of it as common before. And also, I don't think we thought of it as an opportunity. We thought of it as a problem as opposed to an opportunity.
Nicola, one advance in recent years on the understanding of hybrids follows from genome sequencing. How has that helped?
Over the last 15, 20 years, sequencing technologies have increased dramatically. So it's now fairly easy to sequence the whole of an individual's genome. And as a result of that, people have gone around sequencing different species. And that has revealed this kind of high level of hybridization that Sandy was talking about, particularly between animals. So it's maybe realised that this was happening between plants before, but people hadn't really realised that this was so prevalent between animals. And the reason that we can see it when we look at the whole genome is that in the past, we were maybe restricted to actually having to directly observe these hybrids happening. Whereas in the genome, we can look at all of the exchange that's happened between species over the whole history, the whole of their evolutionary history. So any genetic exchange that's happened over several thousand or millions of years, we can detect by sequencing genomes and comparing them. So this has really sort of revealed how prevalent this hybridization is, and it's also what allowed us to detect that hybridization between humans and Neanderthals was through sequencing the whole genome of humans and Neanderthals. We should also say that there is also hybridization can also be a negative force. So there are some cases where two species are very well adapted to their environments and the hybrids are less fit. And then the hybrids will be selected again. So it's not always the case that this hybridization is positive.
I mean, to go back briefly to Darwin and in relation to that, one of the reasons Darwin studied this issue of cross and self-fertilization is that he was very concerned because he had married his cousin, Emma, and his other cousin, Francis Galton, the founder of eugenics, and of my department at UCL, come to think of it, was persuaded that cousin marriage was a bad thing. But Darwin had 10 children, so obviously in his case it didn't seem to do much damage. But what's interesting, and less frequently pointed out, is that in later in the Darwin generations, his children had fewer of their own offspring than average, perhaps because these different groups of genes were indeed beginning to get mixed up and exposing this hidden damage.
I think that oftentimes in plants, at least, is when a hybrid is formed that actually is less than the sum of its parts. So it's something that's not an opportunity. It's not an advantage. They're often sterile and they don't persist. So you'll find a plant that looks as though it's a hybrid. It looks intermediate, but it doesn't set seed or there's a place which I go on a course, and Steve and I've been there together in Spain, and there are two species of rock roses that grow there, and they can cross, but the hybrids between them appear to have no pollen, so they have no male gap, they have nothing to fertilize eggs with, so they're really basically, they grow as individuals, but they just are a lost cause, really.
Given this flow of genes that you've been talking about, how useful is the term hybrid anymore? Do we need another to describe what's going on?
Well, I think it's useful, but I think we need to kind of switch our thinking about hybrid bad and think about hybrid as being mixing. And also, I think the idea that there isn't a thing that's a hybrid. There's gene exchange and a lot of hybridization. So maybe the term hybrid as a thing, like a species, is probably not really very useful anymore.
Are we made up of all sorts of different things in the sequences? I mean, you hear tales about where we share 20% with bananas and 85% with dogs. Where does that take us?
Well, yes, that's true. But that's not.
You that throw isn't... that away. Somebody who is not familiar with this, having 20% sharing with a banana and 85% with a dog, bears thinking about.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's simply a statement of how far in the past our ancestors with bananas or dogs separated from the evolutionary tree. And generally speaking, one of the most impressive things about all this molecular biology stuff is that actually the molecular trees, which are now made in boring abundance, the molecular forests...
Well, they're marvellous, Steve.
Yeah, are remarkably similar, really, to all those old-fashioned taxonomic forests where people looked at bones and blood groups. So there is sense behind all this. The thing which is striking, though, is what we've really found with the molecular side is that an awful lot of this hybrid sterility and so on is due to the fact that actually our bodies aren't made up of little particles. Genes aren't just particles. They interact with each other in a complicated way. And there's a very beautiful example of that in hybrids. There are two little fish called the platyfish and the swordtail. And these are aquarium fish. Some people may know them. One has a long tail and the other one is a close relative and has spots on it. And you can cross them, and people, aquarists do this, and you get hybrids, and they're perfectly happy. If you go to the next generation and you cross the hybrids together, the little spots turn into malignant melanomas, cancers, which kill the hybrid fish. And if you look at the genes, that's exactly the same gene as causes human malignant melanoma. And what's happened is that the fish with spots, the platyfish, they've got a gene that causes their cells to divide slowly. The other one has got a gene that causes those cells to divide fast. And so the genes which are harmless in one fish are lethal when mixed with the genes from another fish. And that keeps a lot of hybrids apart for simple genetic reasons.
But you get that same thing in plants, and you back cross. So plant breeders will make a cross, and then they'll back cross it to one of the parents, and they'll do a series of crosses. And sometimes you get... So you can get that, but you can also get the other side. So it goes both ways.
Nicola, how do environmental changes and circumstances affect hybrids?
Well, we've heard a little bit about how disturbance can cause species to come together that haven't been together before. So in that respect, environmental disturbances can increase hybridization. But there's also the possibility that hybridization can allow species to adapt to new environments. So, for example, the butterflies that I work on, we've just started working on adaptation to altitude. And we know that there's genetic exchange going on between some of these species. So what we're quite interested in is whether some of the widespread species are adapting to higher elevation by actually getting genes from the high elevation species that then allow them to spread up to higher elevations. So thinking about this in terms of the context of kind of environmental change or climate change, it's possible that hybridization between species could allow species to exchange genes that allow them to adapt to new climates and increase sort of this adaptive potential. And hybridization is really this key source of adaptation, because the genes that you get from another species have already been tested by selection. So if we're having if the alternative is that you have to have sort of new mutations and they are completely random and we don't know if they're going to be beneficial or not, the advantage of getting genes from another species is that those genes are already adapted to a particular environment.
Steve?
And then you. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about climate change, the classic example is in Europe. Of course, in Europe, 20,000 years ago, we were covered in ice. So that many, many European creatures, which you are familiar with, crows, hedgehogs, and so on, some of them were pushed down to the southern tip of Greece, some of them to what's now Spain. And as the ice retreated, they all began to move forwards. And they all met, many plants and animals, in a zone which grows across Germany and partly across Italy and partly across Scotland. And this is what we call a hybrid zone. And the mice, for example, they mate there, but the hybrids aren't fit. And that's the remnant of some environmental change over 10,000 years or so, which shows that hybridism can really tracks the environment very carefully.
Finally, Sandy, what changes do you anticipate in man-made hybrids?
Well, I think there are a lot of man-made hybrids because most of, as Steve said earlier, most of the foods that we eat, the major staples of our economy and our diet are hybrids. And I think one of the things that's happening in plant breeding that I find quite interesting and quite exciting, actually, is that as people have bred these crops trying to get hybrid vigor and increase yields, they've become narrower and narrower and narrower genetically, which actually makes them more and more disease susceptible. So our agriculture is quite vulnerable. Agricultural crops are quite vulnerable. So what plant breeders are thinking about now is tapping into that variation in wild relatives, so other species, to try to introduce, just as Nicola said, genes which have been tested in environments, into the crops that we, into the foods we eat, that will allow us to grow them in new areas under new climates.
Well, thank you very much, Sandy Knapp, Nicola Nardeau and Steve Jones. Next week, it's the Treaty of Limerick, 1691, that ended the Williamite War in Ireland after the battles of Boyne and Aughrim and spurred thousands of Irish troops to leave for France, known as the Flight of the Wild Geese. Thank you for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
But so the thing about these hybrids and the crops is I'm not completely convinced that people didn't have something to do with it. So people always assume that this just happened and it happened in nature and people took advantage of things that happened in nature. But if you go to indigenous communities in Peru, for example, they're doing crosses between different potato varieties. So I'm not convinced that just because it's not written down, it's sort of prehistoric.
Yes, that's certainly true. And of course, the use of these in potatoes in particular, of course, the other great issue was the Irish potato famine. And that was absolutely due to what Sandy said during the main body of the programme, which is that an awful lot of these crop plants, and in those days, potatoes most of all, were absolutely identical in their billions.
But that's partly because potatoes are vegetatively reproduced. Yeah, so you don't plant potatoes with seeds, you plant potatoes with bits of a potato. So what you had essentially a single individual potato
growing over the whole of Ireland. And Europe.
And Europe, too.
It's called the lumper. And what happened was a fungus came across and killed them all. Huge. And it had enormous political implications. 1848 was the year of revolutions in Europe. That was starvation. And that was the failure of the potato crop. And really quite soon, people realised you have to bring in every generation new resistances. And they do that with enormous efficiency. There's I think it's in Leiden, isn't there? There's a research station where every year they check what the fungus is likely to be. And they change the potatoes. It's a bit like flu shots. You have to change change them every year, and the same with croplands.
Well, Phytophthora is an oomycete, so it's kind of related to fungi and isn't really a fungus.
Yeah, well,
but
that's true.
But it's right. It's okay. It's called but anyway, it's a really interesting organism because it has lots and lots of what people used to call junk DNA, so lots of repetitive bits in it. And apparently it kind of rearranges its genome all the time, and so it is definitely an arms race. Mm-hmm. And there are potato breeder people work on Phytophthora here in England. There's a whole group at the John Innes Centre and the Sainsbury Labs who work on evolution of Phytophthora and how that all works.
That's the parasite, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating disease, but horrible if a potato field gets it.
Mm. Is this not also a big problem for bananas that...
Now, and sudden oak death is also a Phytophthora.
There's tons of this now going on, the various trees going, you know, there was ash being attacked. And so this
Elder went, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. And this is all really part of the same thing. It's we're disturbing the habitats, we're mixing new groups together, and we're paying the price.
So sort of going back to the idea of, or this kind of come up, is hybridization good or bad? And I think we're generally coming down on the side of good, but I think possibly within conservation biology there's still to some extent this idea that species have to be kept distinct and to some extent populations, so you don't necessarily want to mix them. And I think that's sort of quite an open area where there's not been that much done in terms of what is the optimal level of mixing in order to maintain diversity and keep things genetically diverse enough that they're not prone to disease, but at the same time maintain these locally adapted.
It's called a circularity in this. I'm always amused by the fact that the species which are spectacularly beautiful and so on have lots and lots of different species names. You know, the wildcat. There's the Scottish wildcat. There's the French wildcat, and they've all got species. They're the same bloody cats. But if you can say, oh, there's a group of 20 species here, all of which are going to go extinct, the public and the taxpayers are going to pay 20 times as much attention to them.
Sandy, when there's such a flow of genes, how useful, to go back to something I raised a little earlier, how useful is the term hybrid?
Well, I think it's kind of like how useful is the term species and how useful is the term hybrid. They're sort of mirror images of one another. And I think the term hybrid, I think it's probably not particularly useful anymore because we know that if you look at the whole genome of something, there's hybrid bits all in it. So we're all a bit of a hybrid. But you can still tell species apart, even though they contain bits of other species. And I think that's actually what's really interesting about it, is the fact that there is all this gene exchange, but yet we can still, what we call, diagnose species. So we can tell them apart, so we can actually talk practically about something in order to be able to conserve it or use it in plant breeding or study its relation to elevation. Or because if we couldn't talk about those units, even if they're not perfect, because actually, to be fair, nothing's perfect, is it really?
So with all this constant flow, is it leading to, do you think, more diversity, Steve, or less?
It's hard. Evolution is a bit like the Red Queen race. You have to run like mad to stay in the same place, and that's been going on for millions of years. At the moment, we're running like mad, but I would say going backwards, both in terms of hybridization and everything else, because we're losing diversity at an enormous rate in terms of simple extinction. Every species that goes extinct, and there are millions of them, is a little diverse set of genes which is no longer with us. So in that sense, it's clear we're losing diversity. Having said that, in terms of hybridization, and one of the things which is very much happening is that as the climate warms, lots of tropical plants and animals are moving into the temperate zones, for example, in Britain here. And there's much discussion that many of these may hybridize, for example, with some of our garden plants, our decorative plants, whose ancestors came from the tropics. And in that case, we'll have more variable garden plants. So I don't think there's a simple answer to your question.
But I think the more important loss of diversity is not through hybridization. It's through the change in land use and the way we as a species are trashing the environment is a much bigger driver of loss of species or change of species than is hybridization.
Do you find that?
Yes, I would broadly agree with that. I mean, there are certainly known cases where human changes have resulted in species collapsing. So I think there's one example, I think, of some fish in Leitz in Switzerland that were a distinct species, and then eutrophication led to them hybridizing because they no longer had the same habitats, or they no longer had distinct habitats. Yeah. So there are known examples where human changes are resulting in hybridization leading to species collapse, but I think a much stronger force is definitely
parking lots
or just getting rid of habitats and
direct just parking extinction. You work with butterflies in the garden. Far fewer butterflies than there were 40 years ago.
That's
or something.
Certainly true.
Far fewer.
That's not just butterflies. I remember when I was not very good bird watcher when I was a kid, I used to go out into the Dee Estuary, the Welshing, off the Wirral, and, you know, see 20 or 30, and hear 20 or 30 curlews. I'm really lucky to hear one now. And that's simply a statement of the enormous damage we're doing.
In the fells where I am in Cumberland, you see one and it's a bit of an event.
Yeah.
Well, our use of pesticides and herbicides and a lot of chemicals actually with sort of unknown effects. So we have something and we think that's great. That's going to deal with the potato blight. You know, we'll spray it with chemicals. We'll deal with the potato blight. And that's really why people are trying to hybridize wild species with crops so that we aren't so dependent on these chemicals, so that we can stop destroying species in that way.
I think the producer is aching in the slips.
All right. Does anyone want tea or coffee or tea and coffee?
No, we're fine.
No. Happy.
Nobody wants...
Nothing for anybody?
Nope, nothing for anybody.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
In Our Time with Melvyn Bragg is produced by Simon Tillotson.
Here's a question. A man escapes from one of the world's most brutal dictatorships. He's risked everything to do it. But once he's free, he digs a hole and he tunnels straight back in again. Why? I'm Helena Merriman, and over the past 6 months, I've been investigating an extraordinary escape story for BBC Radio 4, a story involving a tunnel, a spy, and an American TV network. To subscribe, search for Intrigue, Tunnel 29 on BBC Sounds,